Welcome to the February 9th service of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Blacksburg, Virginia. Our service today is led by our minister, Reverend Pam Phillips, and the title of her sermon is, What's Joy Got to Do with It? The podcast begins with a reading read by Worship Associate Stephen Henninger.
Today's reading is from Sharon Salzberg. Many years ago, a friend of mine, someone very committed to self-awareness and passionately committed to social justice activism, said to me, "You know, I feel guilty all the time for the suffering of this world, the suffering that I haven't been able to ease. Knowing the likely conditions in which it was harvested, I can't even let myself enjoy eating a banana." We all make personal, ethical choices, of course. But at the time, my friend was in a pretty deep state of depression. He wasn't at all claiming that the sacrifice of enjoyment was the cause of his depression, or that the depression prevented him from enjoying the banana. He knew, with his keen self-awareness, that he tended to push away pleasure. He sensed that he was more attuned to suffering than joy. He also sensed that he was bone-deep tired. American society, by and large, can be suffering-phobic. We are taught to be ashamed of our pain, our fear, and our difference. We are taught to avoid the suffering of others as though we will somehow be tainted if we witness it too closely. We're taught that we do better to hide the suffering away. For the sake of resilience, we not only need to learn to relate to suffering with compassion instead of disdain, we also need to be able to accept and absorb pleasure. If we can't, we will burn out. There's an awful lot of suffering around, and trying to be fully awake to its demands, energy, balance, perspective, and the ability to let go of attachment to results. There's a lot of bad news out there, but there is good news too, if we stay open to it. In the Buddha's terms, real, true happiness can be seen as an arm of resilience. Happiness is not about feeling like everything's great, but about recognizing our inner resource of self-trust and our connection to others that keeps us from feeling depleted by tough emotions and experiences. In my first years studying meditation with one of my teachers, Munindra, a fellow student once asked him why and how he came to practice meditation. I expected a studious response, perhaps a pious one, but Munindra's answer totally surprised me. Without hesitation, he replied, "I practice meditation so that I can notice the small purple flowers by the roadside that we otherwise miss." This is the essence of mindfulness, paying deliberate attention and doing so with an open heart. His answer really got to the heart of taking in joy and being nourished by it. Rejoicing in something beautiful doesn't have to mean the same thing as attachment. Allowing ourselves to enjoy a delightful experience with an open heart enhances our capacity for generosity and gratitude. We feel capable of being loving and connecting, and we want others to be able to feel the same. In that recognition, we see, with strength, that we are not fundamentally isolated, that our lives really do have something to do with one another. Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh said, "Happiness is available. Please help yourself." Helping ourselves could not only amount to our own happiness, but also to our commitment to the well-being of others.
Thanks. I accidentally dropped that. So endeth the sermon. In the Buddhist terms, real, true happiness can be seen as an arm of resilience. That is the seed out of which this service has grown. Its author, meditation teacher Sharon Salzberg, is one of my favorites. I've read some of her books, listened to her guided meditations, and even had the great good fortune of sitting in meditation with her once in Charlottesville. So when she writes something, it catches my attention. And as I considered how to approach resilience, which is our theme this month, the idea of talking about happiness really appealed to me. The theme, I admit, filled me with some trepidation because it brought to mind the need for resilience. It brought to mind those times in my own life when I needed to be resilient. Although, at those times, I probably wasn't thinking, I'm being resilient. I was probably hanging on by my fingernails, wondering how I was going to make it through. And only afterwards did I realize that I must have been resilient because I did make it through. But even more than my own trials and tribulations, I think of those of others, of people who seem to meet stress, disappointment, loss, and even tragedy with such grace and strength, with such resilience that I marvel at their ability to go on in spite of seemingly insurmountable odds. And I know that I could not ever be like them. And I think of those who, like Sharon Salzberg's friend, are passionately committed to social justice activism, who face the wrongs of the world and work to right them, who are tireless in their efforts, but also realize that there is so much wrong in the world that their efforts might not make all that much difference. I think of a friend of ours in Charlottesville who often says, "It's my job to make the world better, and I'm not doing a very good job of it." I think of people like Sharon Salzberg's friends who say something like, "You know, I feel so guilty all of the time for all of the suffering of this world, the suffering that I haven't been able to ease. Knowing the likely conditions in which it was harvested, I can't even let myself enjoy eating a banana." Does that resonate with anyone? When we recognize that we are part of the interconnected web of all existence, we realize that we are wittingly and unwittingly responsible for some of the suffering in the world, some of the need for resilience. And that can be daunting as well. So now that I've told you all the reasons why the theme of resilience gave me pause, you'll understand why I gravitated toward the need not for resilience, but for embracing and cultivating pleasure and happiness and joy as an arm of resilience. Don't worry, we'll get back to suffering on another day. Maybe even next week. But for today, let's consider happiness. Because as Salzberg writes, for the sake of resilience, we not only need to learn to relate to suffering with compassion instead of disdain, we also need to be able to accept and absorb pleasure. It seems odd that we might have to be intentional about accepting and absorbing pleasure. Don't we all seek pleasure? Aren't we all a bunch of pleasure seekers? Can you think of times when you denied yourself instead of accepting pleasure? Can you think of a time? Sharon Salzberg tells about a time when she was leading a retreat in the dead of winter in Hawaii. And instead of letting herself enjoy the glorious weather, She felt guilty about her friends who were still stuck in cold and snowy places. In response to their letters, instead of telling them how wonderful it was, she said, "Oh my gosh, it is so humid here." She writes, "I spent a great deal of time in Maui preventing myself from connecting directly to the pleasurable experience, and instead distracted myself with feelings like guilt and self-deprecation. Perhaps I assumed that by distancing myself from pleasure, I would protect other people from getting jealous. Or perhaps I felt I wouldn't be abandoning my winter-burdened friends if I didn't enjoy where I was. Or maybe it's just hard for me to let in the joy, to admit fully that I deserve to be happy, just as I am committed to the well-being and happiness of others." Our friend Tim Pickering and Patty Bass, they are on a cruise to Hawaii. Having already read this from Sharon Salzberg, I said to Tim, "Please enjoy 5 minutes of sitting in the sun for me." I hope they're well, it's probably still night there. But anyway, if you go someplace warm, enjoy the heck out of it for me, please. Don't feel guilty. But does that resonate for anyone? The idea that we can't enjoy something, either for someone else's sake or because we don't feel like we deserve to be happy. Sheryl Sandberg, in the book Option B, addresses the guilt survivors feel when a loved one has died. "Why was it them and not me?" She calls survivor guilt a thief of joy. Like many who have lost someone, she wouldn't let herself feel happiness for quite some time. But then she got a kind of permission to begin to feel pleasure again when her brother-in-law reminded her that her husband had always wanted to make her happy, saying, "He would want you to be happy, even now. Don't take that away from him." That and the recognition that her unhappiness was adversely affecting her children helped her to engage in activities that would give her and her children pleasure. She writes, "Having fun is a form of self-compassion. Just as we need to be kind to ourselves when we make mistakes, we also need to be kind to ourselves by enjoying life when we can." And so she was intentional about enjoying life, playing games with her children, watching Game of Thrones, doing things that had always given her pleasure, and taking on new activities. She also practiced the intention of letting herself be happy by writing down at the end of each day 3 moments of joy. Not big flashy moments, but little everyday ones, like how good a warm breeze feels or how delicious a French fry tastes. She says, especially when it's on someone else's plate. And she writes admiringly of her mother, who she says is the most optimistic person she knows, who spends a few moments being grateful for the comfort of the pillow under her head when she goes to bed at night. I love that. No matter how awful my day might be, if I lie down and am grateful for that pillow under my head, that's one bit of joy. It takes time and intention, but even after a loss, we can reclaim joy. And happiness is possible in the most dire of circumstances. Salzberg says, happiness is not feeling like everything's great, but about recognizing our inner resource of self-trust and our connection to others that keeps us from feeling depleted by tough emotions and experiences. When we're in the midst of troubled times, it can seem impossible to feel happy. But examples abound of those who are able to recognize their inner resources and their connections to others. Extreme examples come from those who suffered through such horrendous experiences as the Holocaust. Such is the case in these words attributed to an unidentified survivor of Dachau and Auschwitz, who writes, "There are always compensations. The only real prison anyone knows is himself. The Gestapo tried to make life additionally hard to bear for the more intelligent by having them collect the garbage and empty the slop jars. All the professors were assigned to this job, and I was made to join them because I had a PhD. Actually, it became the one happy experience of my imprisonment. Because of the conversations we had about history, philosophy, systems of politics, and our observations of how the place was affecting the guards, ourselves, and our fellow prisoners. You make your own happiness," this survivor concludes. "You make your own happiness. We make our own happiness." I suppose that's true, but I don't want to suggest that if you're not happy right now, that it's your fault. If a prisoner in a concentration camp can find happiness, then so should you. That sounds like a terrible joke. But I'm mindful that the story of this survivor is told after the fact. We can find what saved us after we've been saved much more easily than when we're in the middle of it. I wonder whether he would have recognized this as happiness at the time. And like Salzburg's friend in our reading, who was deeply depressed and bone tired, there are times and circumstances when it can be a real struggle to feel happiness. To feel joy. What I'm suggesting instead is that even in those times, we deserve happiness. We deserve pleasure. We deserve joy. And accepting and absorbing them isn't necessarily an act of selfishness, but a way to replenish ourselves. Our spirits, so that we can overcome whatever is weighing us down, whether it is our own circumstances or the weight of the world. As Salzburg writes, allowing ourselves to enjoy a delightful experience with an open heart enhances our capacity for generosity and gratitude. We feel capable of being loved and connecting, that we are not fundamentally isolated, that our lives really do have something to do with one another. Experiencing happiness and joy reconnects us to our own resilience and to others. But we sometimes need to be intentional in finding moments of joy. Like the monk who takes up meditation so that he can notice the small purple flowers by the roadside that we otherwise miss. So if you haven't seen any joy, and if you can put out of your mind climate change, I invite you to walk up here at the end of the service and see these buds that are already showing color. These are our small purple flowers by the side of the road. Last week, I shared one of the spiritual exercises from the packet our small groups use, to list 5 resiliency practices and habits. Anyone do that? Oh my goodness. I give you homework, and what do you do? Nothing. All right, well, this is good then, because I'm going to give you another piece of homework. Because it fits so nicely with the story of the monk with the purple flowers, I'm going to share another one of the spiritual exercises in the packet. It's based on the words of Barbara Kingsolver, who says, "In my own worst seasons, I've come back from the colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard for a long time at a single glorious thing. A flame of red geranium outside my bedroom window. And then another, my daughter in a yellow dress. And another, the perfect outline of a full dark sphere behind the crescent moon. Until I learned to be in love with my life again. Like a stroke victim retraining new parts of the brain to grasp lost skills, I have taught myself joy over and over again." Barbara Kingsolver is kind of a good writer, isn't she? So here's the spiritual practice. It's very simple. Stare at a single glorious thing each day for at least a week. So that means when you leave here today, find one single glorious thing to stare at. And then tomorrow, and tomorrow, and so when I ask you this question next Sunday, you'll all go, "Yes, I did it." What's that? Encouragement, not guilt. As the Soul Matter packet says, it can be the same glorious thing, or you can seek out a different one each day. So if you're lazy, find one really good thing today and visit it every day for the rest of the week. It's the staring that is the really important part, they write. Give it your attention long enough to sink in. You will know when you are done. Your body will tell you. Just stare until, like Kingsolver, it teaches you joy once again. You may not be in your own worst season, as Kingsolver was, but as we discovered last week, we can rehearse resilience. We can open our eyes and our hearts to opportunities for joy and pleasure, and accepting them, absorbing them, can keep us from burning out when we're faced with bad news, our own or the world's. And if you are in one of your worst seasons, know that it's possible to still experience joy. Catholic priest and teacher Henry Nouwen makes a distinction, writing, "Joy is not the same as happiness. We can be unhappy about many things, but joy can still be there." Perhaps this is what the Holocaust survivor felt, experiencing joy with his fellow PhDs in the midst of unspeakable unhappiness. But as a theist, Nouwen attributes this ability to be unhappy but still find joy. He attributes that ability to his knowledge of God's love. He writes that joy is the experience of knowing that you are unconditionally loved and that nothing, sickness, failure, emotional distress, oppression, war, or even death, can take that love away. And he's talking about God's love. Nouwen's faith and trust in God's love is powerful. And there was a time when I felt that I couldn't share it because my own conception of God had changed. Perhaps some of you may feel the same way. But I've come to realize that it's possible to have deep faith and trust in life, in love, in the miracle of the interconnected web of existence. Knowing that we are part of something much greater than ourselves, that we are never completely alone, can help us appreciate Nouwen's faith and his belief that sorrow and joy can exist together. He writes, "That isn't easy to understand. But when we think about some of our deepest life experiences, such as being present at the birth of a child or the death of a friend, great sorrow and great joy are often seen to be parts of the same experience. Often we discover the joy in the midst of the sorrow," he writes. "I remember the most painful times of my life as times in which I became aware of a spiritual reality much larger than myself, a reality that allowed me to live the pain with hope. I know this to be true. When my father died, I discovered joy in the midst of sorrow. In the presence and love of our family and friends, and all the reminders of my dad's love for us. We found my mother's last anniversary card to him. It was on a simple piece of paper. And on that paper, she wrote about feeling bad that she couldn't go out and get him a card. She knew it was their last anniversary. And she wrote about how she felt bad that she couldn't express how much she loved him the way he could. We can find joy in the midst of sorrow. I'm guessing you can call to mind your own memory of discovering joy in the midst of sorrow. But as Nouwen reminds us, still, nothing happens automatically in the spiritual life. Joy does not simply happen to us. We have to choose joy and keep choosing it every day. Here's your last assignment for the week. Choose joy.